And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. And today we visit with Harvard University Professor Joyce Chaplin. I'm Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Professor Chaplin has written a chronicle of some 500 years of humans encircling the Earth by many means. Her book is Round the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. And she joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you so much.
And great to have you here. Your own journey inspired this book. Tell us about it, will you?
I didn't go around the world.
Right.
I was doing a much smaller journey. In the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, I'd gone to teach at a semester at sea program on a tall ship, a sailing ship, crossing the Gulf Stream from Bermuda to Nova Scotia. And it was a sailing experience. It was supposed to be like those of the Age of Sail. We weren't supposed to bring cell phones. We weren't supposed to have contact with the internet. So we all brought a lot of reading material. And I brought a copy of Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days in French in order to brush up my French. And that started the project. I was intrigued at the idea of going around the world in an 80-day measure, which would have been impossible in the Age of Sail. So I was curious, when I got back on land, what history of around-the-world travel Jules Verne's novel would fit into. And there was no history of around-the-world travel, so I decided to write one.
It must have been a wonderful experience to be at sea in a tall sailing vessel, no engine sound, just quiet and peaceful. Maybe some rough seas, but...
We didn't have much rough weather. The Gulf Stream was a little rough, but... That was really quite interesting. It was very quiet. It seemed amazing to look up at airplanes going so much more quickly than we were. And it was quite peaceful. And we had to learn how to get along with each other and how to handle the ship. And it was, in a sense, a very interesting view back into the past that I wouldn't have got just from reading about it.
So it piqued your interest. What was it about the Renaissance that motivated people to want to explore?
Mostly desire for money and power. Most of the great expeditions that set out from Europe during the early modern period were imperial. They wanted to expand the empires that the first European nations to have overseas empires were creating. So when Magellan sets out in 1519... he wants to get to the Spice Islands, what we would call Indonesia, which were the center of the spice trade that Portugal controlled, and Spain wanted to get in on that trade. Magellan sails across the Atlantic Ocean and is convinced he can reach the Moluccas, the Spice Islands, in that direction. So he's really sneaking up into somebody else's empire through the back door, as it were. That was the intention.
I was surprised to learn that Ferdinand Magellan was not the first person to circumnavigate the globe. What happened? What were your findings about him, his journey, and his demise?
He's the most famous person not to go around the world. Everyone does think of him as the first circumnavigator, but he didn't make it back. He sets out with about 270 men in five ships, and the whole fleet just keeps being eroded and getting smaller and smaller as they make their way first to the Philippines, where Magellan himself is killed in a military skirmish. And then they keep losing ships and men, the survivors, as they head onward to the Spice Islands, and then even from there, so that eventually only one of the five ships makes it back to Spain with about 18 survivors. Other survivors joined them for a total of 35, but 86% mortality rate, not good.
I'm sure many people, of course, are aware of the portable GPS system, and it's called the Magellan. Now I get the link.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right.
So he goes around. It goes around in the name of the most famous man who never went around the world, but the first to lead, at least in part, successful circumnavigation. So that's his claim to fame.
And tell us about Enrique. I guess he's the one that actually did go around the world, and he was a captive circumnavigator?
He was. He is, as far as we know, he's an Asian man, a slave that Magellan had acquired in the Battle of Malacca. So his name is, the only name we know him by is Enrique de Malacca. Magellan brings him back to Spain, and when he sails to the Spice Islands, he brings Enrique with him, probably as somebody who could be an interpreter and might know the landscape, might know navigation, and is, in fact, very, very useful once the fleet makes its way into the Indian Ocean. After Magellan is killed, Enrique flees. He leaves the ships because I think he's afraid that the other Spanish are not going to treat him very well. And if he made it back home anywhere between the Philippines and Malacca, then he would have been the first man to go around the world.
You call your book a geodrama. What does that mean?
That's a term that I coined to describe human action on a planetary scale. Going around the world is the longest tradition of an activity on a planetary scale that humanity has had. It's lasted for almost 500 years. So to describe it, I have this term drama, meaning an action, and geo, meaning the earth or Gaia from geography, to describe something that has been done, an action that has been done on the scale of the entire earth, again, for almost 500 years.
So your geodrama has three acts: fear, confidence, and doubt. Can you explain, tell us how they repeat themselves as well?
Fear, very obvious for the very first period, starting with Magellan's expedition, where, again, there is 86% mortality rate. And that kind of mortality rate remained the standard until the end of the 18th century, until the late 1700s. Quite incredible. So for the first 250 years, for about half the history of going around the world, expeditions would routinely lose 80th, 90th, 70th percentiles of their crews, almost all of their ships or all of their ships. So a lot of people try to get around the planet, but it's so difficult in the age of sail with the wooden sailing ships, with the long stretches of ocean, with the lack of supply stations that have been established. So many people try to get around the world, but the world just shrugs them off. It's really quite difficult. So anyone who had set out to do it before the late 1700s was probably wise to be fearful. That was an absolutely good emotion to have in the face of what was probably going to happen. Gradually, however, it becomes easier, partly through technology. Sailing ships do finally get better. Early on, they were terrible life support systems, but by the end of the 18th century, commanders of circumnavigations are determined to make the ships better at supporting human life. They stock them better with food and water. They make strategic stops to get supplies. And that obviously helps a lot. Eventually, with steam-powered vessels, getting around the world doesn't take as long. Stops can be predictable. They can be scheduled. That also makes it easier. It helps from the perspective of Europeans that the world is divided among empires they control. And so they can actually create supply stations in port towns, and they can open by treaty access to them, so free trade, so that ships can make landfall wherever it's convenient for them. And that also brings the mortality rate down, makes going around the world seem much safer, more predictable, and something that you could take on with confidence. So confidence is the second act.
We had a guest on a while back. He's the author of COD, Mark. I'm trying to think of his name. But anyway, his theory was that until they were able to salt cod and have that amount of food, they couldn't make these long voyages across the sea.
Mark Kurlansky's
right.
book on
right.
cod.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. They did know how to preserve food, but sailing ships were still quite small. So for going around the world, you needed a lot of food. And there's a tricky balance that you could have an incredibly large ship that technically could take a lot of supplies, but then you need a large crew that are going to eat all the supplies anyway. So for going around the world, it's not only taking enough supplies, but knowing where to stop to get fresh supplies on the way. It's very standard for crews trying to get around the world to develop scurvy at some point because they run out of fresh food. You can only live so long on salt provisions. And interestingly, the early mariners were convinced that scurvy was a kind of sickness that they got because they were away from land too long, and that merely being back on land would cure them. But for going around the world, you're crossing every ocean, including the Pacific, the world's largest ocean. There just isn't that much landfall you can make, and so staying alive is really, the odds are against that.
And the fetid conditions, didn't some of these ships would have livestock aboard and just some really horrible conditions?
It would be very difficult for us to re-enter those kinds of sailing conditions. And so the tall ship I went out on was, you know, pristine, clean. We had lots of fresh food. We had refrigeration. And the whole experience is completely different when you really have a power source, for instance, that can provide heat, that can keep food cool, that can cook food under any variety of conditions. But these are amenities that these early sailing ships absolutely did not have. It's only when those amenities get added that, again, you can have a sense of confidence that if you're going to go around the world in conditions that are going to keep you alive, you're obviously going to be much more confident.
So we have a third act to the drama, Doubt, but we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Joyce Chaplin. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. Her book is Round About the Earth's Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. Stay with us.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Like that, we're speaking with Professor of History Joyce Chaplin. She's written Round About the Earth, and the Beach Boys were not there. Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. So we were talking about your geodrama in three acts, Professor, and how they repeat themselves. We've gotten to fear, confidence. Tell us about doubt.
I was actually going to go back over confidence.
Oh, good. Okay, please do.
Even though the Beach Boys don't figure in my book, I really missed a trick there, obviously. That sense of confidence about going around the world in terms of it being fun, being a tourist activity, being a kind of manageable adventure, that's first something that cruise ships do, obviously, that the commercial travel industry by the early 20th century makes it possible for paying passengers to go around the world in comfort, you know, with fresh fruit, ice cream, vintage wines, you name it. Airline travel, obviously, is what we inherit, commercial airline travel. And I just wanted to mention in relation to the Beach Boys, whom I don't bring up in the book, but I do talk about the great surfing movie Endless Summer, which is about catching the perfect wave and following an endless summer all the way around the world with your beach your surfboard on commercial airline travel. So, yes, good tie-in. Thank you for the music. but the confidence, you know, we still have that, definitely. Going around the world for most people now is something, if they think about it, they probably would think about an adventure they would survive. And so we get that sense of confidence from the age of steam, the 19th century. But we're also living in an era of doubt about the cost of making those kinds of journeys. The doubt first emerged with new dangers for going around the world. So early aviation was not easy in terms of taking on the entire planet in an open cockpit, small aircraft that needed to be refueled pretty much constantly. The first aerial circumnavigation is done in 1924, and it takes a whole team, four planes and eight men from the U.S. Army Air Corps. Two of the planes actually do it. So again, open cockpit, every kind of weather, you would absolutely feel it every minute. And there were fatalities. Amelia Earhart was trying to fly around the world close to the equator, which had never really been done before, when she's lost in the Pacific Ocean.
She began that flight in Miami. Actually, Hialeah.
Yes. The Miami airport has a plaque commemorating her stop.
There's a park, an Amelia Earhart park as well.
And she was absolutely right that she was taking on the biggest circumnavigation. To follow the equator means, you know, doing a great circle around the Earth. But especially in terms of crossing the Pacific, this was quite dangerous. There's very, very few places you can land in order to refuel, and she missed one at Howland Island, and that's where she was lost with her navigator. Also, the space age, going around the world in orbit, amazing triumph, and just amazing characters in the Soviet Union, the United States, and then later other nations that would do that. But incredibly dangerous. It had to be managed and controlled and tightly scheduled in order to make it at all successful. So this reignited that sense of fear, definitely, that would have been typical in the early modern period about going around the world. I think most recently there's now concern that, of course, using fossil fuel to fly around the world or get around the world in another way is not actually good for the planet. So it's demonstrating a kind of mastery that we have over the Earth, but probably at some cost to the physical atmosphere of the Earth. So that's the kind of doubt that we live with, along with the confidence that we've inherited from the 19th century and those reignited fears from the very earliest and the longest period of circumnavigation.
Our topic today is circumnavigation with Harvard University history professor Joyce Chaplin. If you'd like to join in the discussion with a question or comment, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. So who was the first woman to circumnavigate?
A woman, the first known woman would have been Jean Barret. She was a stowaway on Antoine de Bougainville's Around the World voyage in the 1760s. She embarks with her employer, a botanist, who wanted to bring along his servant and probably his mistress. There are suspicions among the French crew that she doesn't seem like either a man or a boy, but they're not quite sure what to make of her. But she's completely exposed in every possible way once they reach Tahiti, and it becomes clear that she is a female stowaway, and explains to the commander, Bougainville, that she wanted to come around with the journey and go around the world, that she had curiosity for doing that, which is really interesting that early from the 1760s, people would have expressed a kind of curiosity, well, I'd like to go around the world, even though it was still quite dangerous. Rather amazingly, she survives, and she eventually makes it back to France and is given a state pension to honor the first woman who goes around the world.
But she wasn't... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
No, please.
I think I was interrupting you by saying that she wasn't... Jean Barret was the first woman to go around the world, but not the first female.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Thank you. I'm so sorry to step on your toes, Bonnie. But yes, the first female known to go around the world, and she did it twice, was a goat. She goes around the world with Samuel Wallace on a British expedition, and then she goes around the world again with Captain Cook on his first voyage. We figure she must have given a lot of excellent milk that she got assigned to a British warship or a British ship twice to go around the world. When she does it the second time, she's basically pensioned off. She's retired with honor. That's enough, I think people probably felt. And she went home with Cook.
It seems that when your accounts of this, many of these early individuals, these daring individuals, were unpleasant and mean-spirited. Why was that?
Well, I think under the conditions early on, you had to be tough to want to do it and to be successful at doing it. And commanding a ship under these conditions, you just really had to have a fairly tight regime. a lot of the men who get this kind of command have come up through the Army or Navy or both, and so they're military characters, and they're not there to make anyone's life pleasant. They're there to get the job done, and that's really kind of reflected in their command. So they are very, very tough. They're also imperialists. They're there to expand the power and the glory of their monarch's realm. So it is a pretty tough business, yes. They're not people I would want to bring home and introduce to my family, no.
But what was the social status of a sailor in the 16th century? It wasn't very high, was it?
No. Now when we think about going around the world, we think of it as a kind of a glamorous, sophisticated, cosmopolitan thing to do. And the irony is that in the early period, anyone who had this sort of sophisticated, cosmopolitan experience was from the very bottom ranks of society. So sailors in early modern Europe did not have very high rank. Often they were regarded as men who couldn't find anything better to do. They weren't very well paid, and they had to be kind of desperate to sign on to certain long-distance expeditions. There was a kind of expectation that they might get rich. So certainly the guys who sign on with Magellan want to get to the Spice Islands and get spices of their own to sell back in Europe, and they're expecting that they're going to make a lot of money off that, little realizing that most of them would not actually survive to do that.
Because global travel originated in Europe, was that the beginning of Western hegemony?
There was a lot of global travel that existed before. So I just want to mention that there had been amazing long-distance sea voyages done in history before.
Vikings.
The Vikings. All of Polynesia had been explored and settled thousands of years before Europeans even know that that ocean exists. There had been famous Chinese expeditions that go into the Indian Ocean and reach Africa. So a lot of different people did long-distance voyages, but only Europeans go around the world. Given the mortality rates in the early period, we might conclude they did this because they were crazy. But they were the first to do this kind of long-distance travel.
You state that circumnavigators were different because they thought of themselves on a planetary scale. I'm just wondering, in our age now of globalization, and now with climate change upon us, don't most of us think on a planetary scale now? Has that changed?
I hope more people are thinking about that. I don't know if it's universal, but certainly there's more of a sense now that we're aware we belong to a global society that has long-distance connections through trade, through technology, and we're more aware of large-scale planetary damage, yes. But these are not the only kinds of planetary consciousness that have ever existed. And I was really interested in around-the-world travel and geodrama as older forms of planetary consciousness and as ones that, again, traced our different relationship to the planet, where, you know, once upon a time, just as with the circumnavigators setting out around the world, there was a sense that it was way too big for us to do any damage to it. That was incredible, to think that individual humans or collectively humans could damage the planet. Then from the period of confidence in the long 19th century, there's a sense that humanity had kind of brought the planet under control with a sense that that was easy to do. You know, the telegraph looped around the world. Travel routes crisscrossed the world, and it was as if we had tamed the entire Earth. And I think now we know very, very well that we can individually or collectively damage the planet. That's a very different kind of planetary consciousness that we've ever had before. And I think we're skeptical, we're kind of nervous about that history of bringing the entire planet under control through technology, because we're beginning to see that that has negative consequences.
We're speaking with Joyce Chaplin, professor of history, early American history at Harvard University. Her latest book, Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper, and we're visiting with Joyce Chaplin, professor of history at Harvard University, Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit is her latest book. And you can join in the conversation, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or radio@WLRN.org.
And first caller, this is Ursula in Miami. Hello, Ursula. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to answer the question that Bonnie Berman posed.
Okay.
You asked who was the first woman to fly around the world, and I assume you meant solo and pilot in command of the airplane. Even though everybody knows Amelia Earhart, who didn't make it, very few people know about Jerry Mock, a housewife from Columbus, Ohio, who was the first woman to actually fly a small airplane, a little four-seater, around the world in 1964. It took that long.
Professor, are you aware of that?
Thank you. I thought the question was the first woman to go around the world at all. Sorry, I didn't realize
right.
It was about
no,
me.
It was.
It was posed that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
We did pose mm-hmm. it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd add this. And there are a lot of women right now who are flying small planes around the world. Well, maybe not a lot, but some who do it to raise consciousness for a ALS or another charity.
In fact, there was a woman who completed successfully Earhart's flight using similar equipment and the same route.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And who was that?
I'm very sorry. I would have to look up her name.
Okay.
I only mention her in passing in the book. This happened very recently in the 1990s when there's been a kind of nostalgic resurgence of interest in going around the world the old ways, if not the hard ways. So a lot of people have replicated either sailing or flying around the world voyages, typically, from earlier periods of time.
How about balloons?
That took a long time. It wasn't until the 1990s when the Breitling Orbiter with a two-man team actually made it around the world as a balloon rather than a zeppelin. Zeppelins, of course, have motors and can be maneuvered around the world, and so a zeppelin had gone around the world earlier in the 20th century. But it wasn't until the end of the 20th century that you could do it with a balloon that did not have any kind of motor or guidance or propulsion, I should say. For that to happen, you really needed excellent, up-to-date weather reports to get in the right wind eddies and to try to follow them over your route. And until then, it was a kind of hit-or-miss proposition. It was just really impossible to get a balloon without any kind of form of propulsion to get around entirely around the world.
What kind of altitudes would we be talking about for around-the-world balloon trip?
I'm not sure what their maximum altitude would have been. And I think they did have to go up and down to a certain extent, as did the Zeppelin when it goes around the world under kind of German aircraft service, where a lot of times they were very, very close to the ground. And interestingly, for a lot of early aviation, the pilots, whether in Zeppelins or aircraft, would follow roads or railway tracks or telegraph lines on the ground in order to navigate. So they actually weren't that far away.
You said that circumnavigation lost its appeal at a certain point. When was that and why? Why did that happen?
I don't remember saying that it lost its appeal entirely.
Its popularity, I guess.
I mean, people, it's come and gone. I would say that now flying around the world on jet aircraft has become banal. Apologies to everyone who has done it, but it isn't as much of an accomplishment as it would have seemed, say, even as late as the mid-20th century. Also, I think that in the early 19th century, there's a comparable moment when it seemed to be getting too easy, where commercial steamships, for instance, and railroads were making it so that, you know, a lot of people could actually do it without much of a sense of risk or danger. And that's actually when the idea of going around the world faster than ever before becomes more popular. And, of course, Jules Verne's novel, Around the World in 80 Days, is a product of that era, a sense that just doing it isn't enough, but doing it under a deadline, faster than anyone had been doing it before. And then eventually using modes of transportation that were unusual, so going around the world by bicycle, first done in the 1880s, and so on and so forth. So whenever it does seem to be getting too easy, people usually kind of nudge up the stakes in order to make it seem exciting again.
And we'll take another caller. This is Marcos in Miami. Hi there.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I was wondering if the author could talk about Joshua Slocum, which I think was the first solo around the world.
Yes, thank you so much. He was. He was a New Englander who was an accomplished sailor and refits a kind of broken-down old sailboat, a rather small boat, called the Spray, and off he goes. And he sails around the world alone. As far as we know, he's the first person to be able to do that. He follows pretty well-known shipping lanes in order to do this, and he takes his time. He's out for a number of years. But it's an extraordinary feat, the idea of taking on the entire planet in this boat, not that much bigger than the human body anyway, and slowly, all by yourself, taking on the whole world. It's a challenge that a lot of other people would take up. So people continue to sail around the world alone. It's in the 1960s that, again, it's becoming a standard thing to sail around the world either alone or with one other person. Francis Chichester in the 1960s, a London businessman, adds a new wrinkle when he does it alone and almost nonstop. He makes one stop in Australia, otherwise nothing else. He's just out there completely alone. And that has given rise to the nonstop, solo, unassisted sailing race, which remains a big kind of competition and exciting prospects for sailors. So we just saw the end of the French nonstop around the world unassisted sailing race, the Vendée Globe. And for the first time, somebody did it in under 80 days. In some sense, if you do it faster, I just think you never sleep. I look at the itineraries of these people and, you know, they sleep in 20-minute shifts in order to keep the boats, their sailboats going. On the other hand, going faster means you're out there all alone for less time.
Right.
It's just an amazing feat, amazing test of a sailor.
It seems like they're always upping the ante.
Yes.
I mean, you know, almost like stunts, you know. I mean, we're going to do it faster. We're going to do it without sleep. We're going to do, you know.
Yes. As soon as it becomes easier, then people want to make it difficult again.
Right.
And there's, you know, there are any number of wrinkles. The average age at which you can go around the world. So younger and younger people are trying it all the time. I hope this will continue to be safe for them to do. But I think what's interesting throughout is this sense that the planet is the measure of human endeavor and achievement. And that's where the circumnavigation, again, has this kind of complete history for us for 500 years, that we test ourselves against it. That's the measure that somehow we all agree is meaningful.
So it still matters going, I mean, how many satellites do we currently have going around the Earth?
You'd have to count both the ones that still work and then the ones that don't. There's a whole kind of orbiting graveyard. Or a museum of defunct technology that's up there, which is actually a problem because it creates the possibility that even working satellites will crash into something and cease to function. So it's actually becoming very, very common that not only do we have all this orbiting technology, but we use it all the time. It's a kind of constant in our lives. So even I'm sitting here alone in a studio booth in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but in some ways I'm going around the world because we're using satellite technology. for people to listen, for people to send in comments. So it's a kind of constant presence in our lives, even though it's invisible.
We certainly take it for granted. You could be in a diner talking to someone in China on your cell phone, and if the call drops, this ridiculous company.
right. Whereas this would have been amazing, even by as late as the middle of the 20th century, the idea that you could make telephone calls for pennies, telephone calls for pennies using satellite technology would have seemed quite amazing.
Professor, do you have a website associated with you, the book, your books?
I have a you can follow my tweets, a lot of them about the book. So I'm at Twitter. I'm at Joyce Chaplin 1. And if you go to the Simon & Schuster website, you can find me as well.
Okay.
So speaking of more uses of satellite technology, definitely.
Exactly. We are speaking with history professor at Harvard University, Joyce Chaplin. Her latest book, Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. One more short break, and we'll return in a moment.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Harvard University history professor Joyce Chaplin. Again, the title of her book is Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. And she's joining us from Cambridge by satellite.
We meet such an interesting cast of characters in Round About the Earth. Was there one that most intrigued you, or is that too hard to say?
Yes, it has too big a cast and too fascinating a cast. But there are some people that are hard not to admire, I'll say. And one of them is a French sailor, Bernard Mautessier, who entered the first nonstop, unassisted, solo around-the-world sailing race and was in the lead when he throws the race, because he thinks that using the planet as the measure of human endeavor is ridiculous. He, in some sense, was inspired by an environmentalist ethic. He was worried about the fate of the Earth in the 1960s, and I think just seemed he was apprehensive that human mastery over the planet was a good thing to brag about. So he just leaves the race and sails around. He just keeps going until he stops some months later in Tahiti. Nice place to stop.
Right.
And opts out. And that's really interesting, to be able to take on the planet and then say, well, no, I don't approve of that. So he's very interesting. He's a beautiful writer. So his account, either in French or English, is really wonderful to read about how he enters this race and how he lives at sea and thinks of himself in relation to all the other living beings around him, and then his decision to drop out of the race.
Wow. Ahead of his time.
Some ways, yes, definitely.
Touch on the first Earthling to orbit. Trick
the
question.
The first Earthling, the first Earthling to orbit. It's like the first female to go around the world, not a human. The first creature to go into space was Laika, and she orbited the planet in 1957 in a Soviet Sputnik that had a life support system but wasn't designed to bring her back. So the Soviets had tried to plan to euthanize her by giving her a timed ration of poisoned food. But the spacecraft malfunctioned and overheated, and she was killed probably through heat exhaustion and panic, even before she could have been given this ration of poisoning. So she is the first Earth creature to orbit the world, and she doesn't come back. But she's the test. That way the Soviets and others know that living creatures can go into orbit and can survive that, which was a real question. So she is the pioneer.
I suppose without circumnavigation, there wouldn't be any need for the international dateline.
Well, that was one of the kind of unexpected discoveries that Magellan survivors make. They come back to Spain and somehow they're a day off and they don't understand. People had theorized, of course, that there couldn't be universal time all the way around the world, that the sun is apparent at different times in different parts of the world, and this means that time isn't universal. But no one had really experienced that, and it's only Magellan surviving crew that say, yes, it's actually true. We discovered this. Crossing what we now call the international dateline was called for several centuries the circumnavigator's paradox, that sense that whether you go east or west, you gain or lose a day on your calendar.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Victor in Coral Gables. I'm short on time, Victor.
Okay, I'll be quick. I just want to make the professor aware that Bank Popular number 5 in January 6, 2012 broke the world record sailing around the world in 45 days, 13 hours, 42 minutes, 53 seconds.
Okay.
That's the most recent sailboat to circumnavigate the world, to go around the world.
I thought it was 20 seconds.
Well, my recollection is 53, Joe. I hate to disagree with you, of all people. 45 days, 13 hours, 42 minutes, and 53 seconds. Every second makes a difference.
Indeed. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
It's interesting that with these sailing records, in some sense, what the sailors are doing is they're double dipping. What they're using to get around the world so quickly is information about the weather, usually yielded by satellites. So it's not they're going around the world, but they're also using all this other technology that's going around the world that would have been impossible, of course, for earlier sailors to have any access to, so that they know what wind patterns not to get into, or they know what wind patterns to get into because they will speed them up. And so they're going around the world, and they're also using a lot of technology that goes around the world as they are. So it's a kind of a double game that they're playing.
I had another surprise. Right at the beginning of your book, you say that the Earth was flat was only a myth invented in the 18th century. Who was it invented by, and for what reason?
Well, in the 18th and 19th century, that's when... It's not one person, but there's
right.
a kind of a sense that the Middle Ages had been dark ages, that was a time of terrible ignorance and superstition when people believed all kinds of nonsense. It was a way of kind of advertising what was modern, what was new about the 18th and 19th centuries, that people at the time really wanted to feel like they were different from people in the past. So all kinds of myths were made up about
the Would that include Galileo then?
Well, I think that has a longer history. But certainly the misperception that Galileo was burned at the stake, which some people will still say, when actually he did survive, he wasn't executed. But there was a sense that, yes, in the Middle Ages, religious fanatics crushed anyone who had scientific knowledge, that people lived in ignorance and superstition. This is all a myth. There was a lot interesting intellectually going on in the Middle Ages. And as far as we can tell, people did not believe the world was flat. That is a myth that was created later. People thought of the world as a sphere in the Middle Ages. And obviously sailors knew that the world was a sphere. Otherwise, none of their navigation would have made sense. They had to assume that they were sailing on a round ball in relation to other planets and stars outside it. So it's just one of those popular ideas that people in the Middle Ages thought the world was flat that was at some point created, and we can't kind of get it out of our cultural system.
Right, right.
It's wrong, but a lot of people think it's true.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasurable hour. We've been speaking with Harvard University history professor Joyce Chaplin, and she's written the book Round About the Earth, Circumnavigation from Magellan to Orbit. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks, Professor. Mm-hmm.
My thanks to both of you.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Special thanks to Michael Stock. You can hear or download free audio archives of this and past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with journalist T.D. Allman about his book, Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State. Ponce de Leon wasn't looking for a fountain of youth, and St. Augustine is not the oldest city in the U.S. On to the calendar. On this day in 1793, 220 years ago, President George Washington's second inaugural at Philadelphia. The shortest address by any president, 133 words. And on this day in 1841, 173 years ago, the inaugural of William Henry Harrison in Washington. His speech was the longest, a deluge of 8,443 words during a snowstorm. A month later, he died from pneumonia. One more while we fondly recall the slimy Johnny LaRue on SCTV. On this day in 1994, 19 years ago, the death of comedian John Candy of heart attack in Durango, Mexico, age 43. 1941. The Blues Brothers, Stripes, Spaceballs, Uncle Buck, and of course, Home Alone. And we leave with a line to his niece from John Candy's Uncle Buck, quote, "How would you like to spend the next several nights wondering if your crazy, out-of-work, bum Uncle Buck will shave your head while you sleep? See you in the car." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.